Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of Podcast Land. This is again Wayne Klingman with Chicago Outfit Blood and Streets. And today we have on a very interesting guest. Yes, we have on probably the best author from Canada I've ever had the pleasure to talk to. Not only is he the best Canadian author, again, I've ever talked to, but he's probably the best-looking man I've ever talked to in the entire nation of Canada. Yes, we mean the famous, really cool, good-looking Nate Henley. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing much better after that fantastic introduction.
Oh, at least we can do for you, sir.
And, thank you.
And I appreciate selling me the Eiffel Tower so cheaply. I didn't think it was that cheap.
It's a bargain. Don't you know? You'll get a lot out of it. Don't worry.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Before we get into our subject of con games and the different con men that made them famous, tell us a little bit about yourself, sir.
Sure. Well, as Wayne noted, I'm Canadian. I live in Toronto, although my family is actually American. I was born in Connecticut, New Haven. I live in Toronto now, and I'm a full-time freelance journalist. I do a lot of boring but important stories for trade and business magazines about winterizing your bulldozer and stuff like that. But I also write crime books. That's kind of the more fun stuff, the true crime, and written a bunch of books and on everything from, you know, Al Capone and American gangsters, did one on methamphetamine, and one of my more recent ones was on cons and con artists, which is kind of why Wayne wanted to talk to me, I guess. And stuff has very old roots, and it's just repackaged, and, you know, people keep falling for a lot of this stuff. It's really quite remarkable.
It is. I mean, it's interesting that we are. I mean, we've all heard of the people get the emails saying that some relative died overseas, left a secret bank account. And I know better than even answer, even click those messages if I get them, but yet people have done so.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of the con games are based on real legitimate business principles. So the email thing that you just mentioned, it's based on simply the lesson that door-to-door salesmen know, that if you knock on 100 doors, probably 99 people are going to say no to whatever product or service you're offering, but that one person says, yeah, sure, I'll buy your vacuum, whatever. So it's the same thing with the email scam, that, you know, they'll send out, you know, thousands or even millions of these things, and all they need is a tiny, tiny number of people to respond, and they make a little bit of money. So it's a very similar principle as to, you know, just a regular salesperson. Only they're selling crap, you know.
I don't make myself sound any more intelligent than I am because I'm dumb as a rat. but I know that I don't have a relative that died overseas in Nigeria. I know that my Uncle Sam didn't leave me $1 billion in a Swiss bank account. I know this. But
shocking.
You think that people, very right. But you think that most people would, if not everyone, would know that.
Well, you would, but, you know, first of all, there's a certain percentage of people will believe just about anything you tell them. You know, it's a small number, fortunately. Then you have, what happens is if you add, once you throw greed into the mix, like the possibility of making some easy money, a lot of people's judgment goes out the window that, you know, they fall for something that they normally wouldn't have fallen for because they think, ooh, I might make some easy cash on this. You had mentioned like the email from Nigeria. They actually call this the Nigerian Prince email. You get an email saying I'm a Nigerian prince and I've either come across this fortune in hidden government money, or quite often they say I'm in jail and I need your help to bribe the guards. So send me a check, and then I'll help. Then once you do that, I will share my fabulous wealth with you. It's based on, by the way, on an old, very old scam from the Victorian era called the Spanish Prisoner. Exact same scam, just it was done with letters. And they've actually had people, like, I couldn't believe it when I looked into this. They've actually, some embassies, some U.S. embassies in Africa actually have warnings telling people not to fall for this stuff and totally not to travel to these countries. They've actually had people, you know, who travel to Lagos, Nigeria, or whatnot, because they're convinced they can negotiate this great deal, and they end up getting robbed or murdered. And there's actually been a few cases of this, and I was just floored that, you know, people would actually fall for this, but some people do. It's really quite remarkable.
Well, I think the greed element speaks highly because, you again, as you said, sir, someone thinking I can make a couple of bucks by taking advantage of this really cool deal.
Right.
Am I smarter than this person so they can't possibly fool me?
But right.
These people, yeah, they've been doing it for a while. So
yeah,
know
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's crazy. You touched on the other element that, in addition to greed, a lot of people fall for scams because they like to think that they're special and smart. That I'm too smart to be ripped off. So yeah, this deal might sound a bit shaky, but you know, no one's gonna con me because I'm far too clever. And there's an actual saying that sometimes smart people are the easiest to con because they think of themselves as so, you know, high and mighty. But yeah, we were talking before the interview started that senior citizens are often one of the main target groups because they often are very trusting. And if they're old, they might have medical issues and they're not quite thinking straight. So sadly, that's one of the key demographics for being ripped off.
Yeah, and speaking of that, my mother, when she had Alzheimer's, when we knew she had it, we took steps to make sure that she could access her bank account because we're terrified that somebody would get a hold of her and say, you know, we can do this for you or we can do that for you or your son, your daughter owes us money. We need it now.
Yeah.
And she'd give it
to them. Yeah, it's pretty sad. I mean, if you're preying on, you know, senior citizens with Alzheimer's, I mean, like, that's pretty damn low, to say the least. But unfortunately, there are people out there who think nothing of it.
Right. Well,
sad to say.
Same type of people who, you know, same type of, if I may say, scum that would probably run over a dog or a cat. I mean, to me, we can find humor in the Sergeant Bilkos of the world, right?
When
Bill Silver's at Beverly Hillbillies shows, right? Because it's funny. It's one thing for it's a TV show. It's another thing when it's your neighbor down the street who has had $20,000 ripped off that she can't get back.
That's right. That's right. Another scam that is very common also, the, you know, internet romance fraud is very, very, very common. Somebody will, you know, charm you up. Oh, you know, you're the light of my life and I just love you and blah, blah, blah. And what happens there is the person says, you know, well, I love you so much and I want to see you, but I'm experiencing these temporary banking problems with my multi-billion-dollar company, and I want to know if I send you a check, can you, you know, wire me the money? And, you know, okay, whatever it sounds. So I'm going to send you an $11,000 check. Because you're such a wonderful person, you can keep $1,000. Just wire me $10,000 through this wire transfer. So what happens is you get the check, you wire the $10,000. And a day later, the check bounces. You are responsible for that $11,000. And because you've used a wire service, it's almost impossible to actually trace the money and get it back. So that's extremely common. And then, of course, you never hear from this person again. Oh, well, you know, sorry about that, but these things happen. So if somebody wants you to, you know, if a stranger on the internet wants you to cash a check for them, no, no, bad idea.
Bad idea. Or when you get the check, when you sell something to someone else and the check to send you is for amount over way over the amount of what you, you know, sold it to them for, yeah, that's another scam you need to be careful for.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like if the person says, you know, I'll buy that, you know, I'll buy your car for, you know, $5,000, your old car, and they send you a check for $50,000. And, oh, well, just wire me the difference. No big deal, you know? Like, no, big deal. You'll be ripped off.
Big deal. Right, yeah.
Yes.
Then it's that time to pick up the phone and call the appropriate authorities, and maybe they can do something before the next person gets even, even tried, you know?
Yeah.
But this is, as we've been talking about, this stuff has been going on for centuries.
Yep.
Probably longer than I've been alive, even, which is quite some time. I understand they used to sell Florida often to people.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, sir?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Sure. Can you tell us about some of the property scams that took place in the state of Florida?
Oh, right. Sorry. 1920s, where there was this huge property boom in Florida, okay? And there's sort of a germ of, like, respectability to this because, you know, Florida at the time was kind of a new, you know, exciting part, you know, area to be in. And so they had some land deals that were totally legitimate. Like, okay, you want to buy some property in, you know, what became Miami Beach. No problem. I'll set it up for you. So you have that. People decided that would be a great place to retire to. So you have some legitimate activity. But then what happened is all these speculators jumped into it and began just selling, like you've heard the expression, being sold swampland in Florida. Well, it actually comes from a real thing in the 1920s. People were being, like, these speculators would say, I've got this amazing property, you know, beachfront Florida property, glistening sand, you know, beautiful climes. And in fact, it was like a swamp in the middle of the state filled with mosquitoes. And you'd have these people at the time who weren't too clued into their geography from, you know, the north or whatever, or the west. Oh, yeah, that sounds great. And they'd be, of course, totally ripped off, or you'd have a land agency that would sell fake deeds. That was another thing. Like, you would buy a deed, pay a ton of money, and you wouldn't even actually have the property. Like, it would be, you know, you'd show up and somebody else had it. Or they'd sell multiple deeds. Like, you know, three different people have the same property. That was common. And eventually the land boom collapsed, in part because so many people were being ripped off. And keep in mind the times, because this is the 1920s. You couldn't just go on Google Maps and check out a property, right? Because nowadays, you know, if somebody offered you a parcel of land in Florida, it'd be very easy to check in on it and see what exactly is there and what the infrastructure is and blah, blah, blah. Back in the day, they didn't have that. So the Florida land boom collapsed. But out of that, like I said, Florida continued to develop, and you did have legitimate real estate people selling legitimate, you know, property. But for this brief period, it was just this crazy, like this, it just became a frenzy, like of primarily, like I said, people from the north or the west buying, you know, fantastic property in Florida, and often they thought that they would buy it and then sell it. So what they weren't even keeping it. They're going to buy this great property and then flip it. Really? Oh, yeah, I'm going to make a ton of money. So you had all these amateurs getting into the market, and it just became, you know, total chaos. And eventually it all fell apart. But historically that left us, like I said, with that expression, you know, being sold, swampland in Florida. To, you know, I've got some swampland in Florida to offer you if you believe that. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that
and
was
I
very... and that was, you know, and these kind of what they call bubbles continue. Like we saw that with the .com thing when the World Wide Web went on, became popular in the late 90s. And some of the investment was totally legit. And then you had fly-by-night people kind of, you know, taking advantage of the frenzy. So these booms are fairly, that is, not an unusual thing. Just the Florida land boom was different because there was so much, like, it became just ridiculously fraudulent, and it's kind of held up, like, as a model for, you know, really sleazy land real estate business.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I know that people back around the gold rush days and they're going to start to decline, same thing with silver mining. You know, salt mines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's pretty big at the time. But now let's talk about some of the players that were involved in some of these scams,
sure,
if we could.
Okay.
Who are some of the ones that we might know of today?
Well, the big one you probably know about today would be Charles Ponzi. And you probably know about him because you've heard the expression Ponzi scheme. Well, that refers to a kind of financial fraud that was not invented by Charles Ponzi, but he kind of made it famous. And basically, he was an Italian immigrant who claimed that he had come up with this great way of making money through international postal coupons. And it's a bit complicated, so I won't explain it all. But basically, there's a price difference in the coupons. And he said, if you buy them cheap and, you know, in Europe, you can sell them for more money in America. Invest in my company. And he promised fantastic returns. It was like, I'm trying to look, it was either 30 or 40% within like 45 days. Oh, sorry, right here. 50% return in 90 days. And then he halved that to 45. So all these people started investing with him. And then it turns out that people discovered that he'd actually served time in jail for smuggling immigrants and for fraud. And the postal people started saying, well, you know, there's not really, like, this is not a good basis for a business because each post office only has, like, you know, $10 worth of postal coupons. It's not like you can buy billions of these things. So the whole thing collapsed, and most of the investors got screwed. And what it had determined was that Ponzi wasn't actually investing in anything. This whole business about postal coupons was all a complete lie, that he'd bought about $20 worth of postal coupons. He was not funding his financial company through the sale of postal coupons. All he was doing was taking money from new investors, giving it to old investors. So he's recirculating cash. That's all he's doing. So as long as new investors keep coming in, no problem. But as soon as new investors stop coming in, or if everybody wants their money back, the whole thing falls apart. And this kind of scam had been around for a while, but it acquired a name thanks to Charles Ponzi, and it's now called a Ponzi scheme. And it's pretty much the same thing Bernie Madoff was doing. Like in his allocution to the court, he openly admitted that he was running a Ponzi scheme. People would invest with him, and they would get fake certificates for bonds and stocks, and he would claim that he had this brilliant investing strategy that, of course, I can't really tell you about. But it turned out he wasn't doing really much of anything. He was just, again, taking money from new people, giving it to old people, recirculating cash, and it all falls apart. So Ponzi was the most famous of scam artists of those day. But interestingly enough, there was another guy named Leo Koretz who was doing almost the same thing, but nobody knows who he is. And a writer named Dean Job wrote a great book about this guy, Empire of Deception. 1920s, Koretz is like a lawyer in Chicago, making good money, but he wants to be rich. So he starts selling fake mortgages, not making enough money. So he basically invents this financial firm, and he claims that he owns all these oil wells in Panama and a timber farm in Panama, and invest in my company, I'll give you big returns. Same shtick, that there was no oil wells, there was no property that he owned in Panama. He was just recirculating money. And his scam fell apart because a bunch of his investors said, well, we're going to go and visit your, you know, oil wells in Panama and check this out, and this will be great. So Koretz, you know, waved them off at the New York dock, you know, oh, see you guys later. And as soon as the ship left, he gathered as much money as he could and took off. And he hid out for a while in New York City, and then he went to Canada and hung out in the Maritimes and eventually was caught and committed suicide in prison in a rather bizarre way. He was very diabetic, and he had a box of chocolate smuggled in, and he ate it all and went into a coma and died. But his scam was actually much bigger than Charles Ponzi's, but for whatever reason, we remember Ponzi's name, but not this other guy, Leo Koretz. But it was similar to the Florida land thing we were just talking about, that nowadays you could go on Google Maps and see if there's oil wells at this location in Panama. And at the time, you couldn't. And Panama was like, you know, people thought of it as on the other side of the moon, you know. Oh, it's so far away. So he got away with this for years, and people thought he was a genius. And he was just, it was all a fraud. So those were probably two of the biggest names at the time. And then, of course, in the 20s, you also had President Harding. Some of his associates were caught up in the Teapot Dome scandal, which was all about leasing oil licenses on, I believe, Indian property in the United States. He wasn't involved with it directly, but his buddies were, and it was all a big, you know, scam. So those are some of the bigger ones from about a century ago.
Right. I mean, we saw some of that stuff going on today. What's going on with cannabis a lot. I find that whole stuff fascinating, and you read about pump and dumps. But pump and dump schemes have been going on forever, too.
Yeah. Pump and dump is interesting. I talk about that in my Big Con book. For people who don't know, basically it's you promote a certain stock. It's easy to do this online now because you can, you can go to like a website that covers the stock market and add all these comments like, oh, hey, you know, have you checked out this stock? It's going really well. Or you can actually just invent your whole, like you can make up a website that allegedly is a magazine and talks about how this stock is so terrific and, oh, it's so great. The idea is to jack the price way up. And as soon as it reaches a certain point, you sell all your stock, make a fortune, and then the price itself collapses because you're no longer promoting it. So it's called pump and dump, and it's still, it still goes on today. The internet has actually facilitated a lot of this kind of stuff. And
yeah,
for people who
I
don't.
Know that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No,
it's the kind of thing that, like, people who don't know a lot about the stock market, it's they're the kind of people who get victimized by this stuff because they're like, you know, they go online and there's all these comments about this stock that's going through the roof and, oh, wow, here's this website and it talks about how great this stock is. I'll put all my money into it. And you don't realize it's all a con. So these things are still pretty common today.
They are. And sadly that even though there's a lot of tools online to determine if something is too good to be true, many people don't take the time to look into it because maybe they have the belief it can't, you know, I'm smarter than this.
Right.
I know, I mean, yeah. So goal to say it's important when you get an approach with an investment opportunity, be it real estate, a stock, or even the Eiffel Tower, which I'm sure you gave me a really good deal on, but you do due diligence.
Yeah, well, it's funny you mention that because when I was doing my research, I found that there was this guy back in the 1800s, 1890s, I think, who actually was selling the Brooklyn Bridge. Like, you've heard that expression, you know, if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. Well, it comes from this guy who was this con man, and he would say, he would go to mostly to new immigrants. This is around 1900, see if I've got my history right. And he'd say, well, I don't know if you knew this about America, but we will sell big chunks of our infrastructure to private sellers. And if you want, I can sell you the Brooklyn Bridge, and you can set up tolls on it and make a fortune. You'll be rich. And he did this about a dozen times. And apparently, police started noticing because, like, people would try to set up customs booths on these bridges. And they'd be like, what are you doing? No, I bought this bridge. This is my customs. And this is my toll booth. And they're like, I don't think so. A lot of this stuff that we think of, like, has become kind of like a jokey expression is actually based on real-life scams. Swampland in Florida, Brooklyn Bridge. I'm sure somebody in Paris has sold the Eiffel Tower many times, you know?
I think it was sold twice by the same person. He used to get people collect them in a hotel room and sell it for scrap. And of course,
I'm not familiar with that one, but it totally sounds like something that people would do. So
right.
That doesn't surprise me.
you can't underestimate, I don't say this to pity, but you can't underestimate the greed of people, how quickly greed will get someone in trouble.
That's right. That's right. One of the books that I read for my research was, it's also called The Big Con. It's from 1940. And it was a professor, David Maurer, who investigated con artists. He actually did his research. And his one conclusion was that it's very difficult to con an honest man. That was his one conclusion, that most scams are leveraged on kind of the greed of the victim. You know, like they're excited about getting rich quick. So if you're like super straight laced and you don't believe in, you know, gambling or making, you know, getting rich quick, or you don't believe in lotteries and that stuff, probably unlikely you're going to get scammed. Although everything, like I say, has to be qualified, because there are cases of very honest, legitimate people who get defrauded. There is an unfortunate thing called affinity fraud, which is where you rip off people in your own social environment. And it's common in churches. You know, you have
yep.
a guy who goes to your church. Oh, hey, he's my best friend, and he's really religious, and he always goes to these, you know, the prayer meetings, and he's got this great, you know, investment opportunity, you know, and hey, he's a good, you know, religious man. He can't be ripping me off. And sometimes they are ripped off, so.
Sometimes they are ripped off. It's really common with multi-level marketing. What I'm going to, for my opinion, in multi-level marketing scams.
Yeah, that's
my mister. Yeah, my mister would have tuned me into this new multi-level marketing if he wasn't told to by God. Like, okay, and that's just bad, because again, you have people trust this is, as you say, self-trusting. You trust the guy that goes to church, you trust the minister, you trust the priest. And he says, "I got this opportunity. God told me to share it with you."
Right.
He's a man of God.
That's right. That's right. That you're in a perfect opportunity to kind of rip people off. It's really unfortunate that people would go to that length to do a scam. But sadly, it does happen. So
it does happen, absolutely. Now, Enron is an interesting case, because that was a Ponzi scheme, correct?
And the what, sorry?
The Enron story?
Enron? The Enron case? I'm
yes,
not... To be perfectly honest, I don't know a huge amount about Enron, so I can't speak to that per se, but I do know that, you know, there's been no shortage of big companies or big corporations that it turns out they're either based on fraudulent activity or, you know, there's some element of, you know, con artistry going on there. Up in Canada, the big one was BRIAX, which was this company that claimed to have found gold in Indonesia, and their stock price went through the roof, and then it turned out that they had, quote-unquote, salted the gold, the samples, which is where you put a little chunk of gold into the sample, and, oh, hey, look at this. Oh, wow, it's gold. So, yeah, but, you know, like, when we speak of con artists, it's not just some sleazy dude, you know, trying to sell you, you know, some sort of like Ponzi scheme, that quite often it is, like, you know, even corporations, you know, whether consciously or not, they get involved with some activity that is pretty shady.
Yeah. What do you do? I mean, you'd think, you'd hope that wasn't the case, or you would hope that the employee who was approached, say, we want you to do this thing that you think is shady. And
yeah.
The employee would do the right thing and say, I won't, I quit.
Yeah, and again, like, you know, to keep circling back, but Bernie Madoff, another perfect example, that this guy Madoff Investments, who was super respected, and he actually made it quite difficult to invest with him. That was his other part of his allure, is that he would make it so, I don't know if I can take you on as a client. So, of course, that makes people want it even more. Oh, no, please take my money. And super, you know, he had, you know, big office building, seemed to be perfectly legitimate and successful. And it was all based on a scam. You know, it was really just astonishing that the extent of his fraud, and he one decent thing he did is that he was relatively honest in court about, well, you know, I defrauded all these people, and here's how I did it, and I did a Ponzi scheme. You know, there's another example of how, a legitimate business sort of, fell over the line into criminal activity.
Now, how much money did his investors get back? Anything? Pennies on the dollar, maybe?
No, they did get back a few billion. There was some lawsuits and court cases to, get some money back. So some people did get money back, but all of it has not been returned. At the peak of Bernie Madoff's activities, I believe he said his company was worth like $60 billion, and that might have been, a little exaggerated, but a lot of people did lose a lot of money, and a lot of those people will never get any of it back. And another chunk of people will get some of it back. But no one's ever, it's unlikely that all his investors are going to make their money back. That money's just gone.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if anybody got much of it back. Well, the lawyers will get paid. We know that much. Lawyers always need to be paid. What's the quote from Shakespeare? The first thing we do is call all the lawyers?
Yes. Shakespeare.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now, but what happened to, now Ponzi's caught. Does he serve any jail time?
Yeah, Ponzi is caught and put on trial. And what's interesting with Ponzi is that he had this allure. Like, he became a big celebrity and, bought a big mansion. And his shtick was that in the 1920s, the stock market and a lot of investment was still seen as a pretty snooty elitist. If you weren't white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and you hadn't lived in America for 200 years, you were kind of looked down on. So his shtick was that anybody could invest with his, his company. That a lot of immigrants loved him because they felt, we're getting a piece of the American, the American dream. And even when he was put on trial, people still supported him. Like, not everybody, but he still had strong support from a lot of people who thought that the federal government was just being nasty and picking on this poor, poor Italian immigrant who come across a great way to make people wealthy, and shame on them. Even when it's exposed that he's a complete fraud and doesn't know, wasn't doing anything legitimate, some people still held on to their certificates from his company and were convinced that he would somehow make right, and had blind faith. He served his time and was released, and eventually ended up in South America doing, he was sort of working for the airline in Brazil, I believe, and was sort of shuttling, arranging to have planes shuttle back and forth. And that all fell apart with the advent of the Second World War. And so he died in a charity hospital in Brazil in 1949. So he didn't keep any of the money that he has, any of his ill-gotten gains. But he did achieve a certain kind of immortality because, like I said, the term, the kind of financial fraud he pulled off is now referred to as a Ponzi scheme. So he sort of became famous in a way.
Very much so. How interesting how history has a way of doing that to people.
Yeah.
Now, if I understand correctly, even the French Revolution was helped along by some type of financial fraud.
Not an expert on the on the French Revolution. So why don't you clue me in, and then I can see if I can comment.
Basically, in a nutshell, someone wanted to have a diamond they wanted to sell. They pretended to sell it to the Queen of France, who knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then people trying to get this deal done kept lying to each other and other people about actually selling it to the Queen of France or not. And it just spun out of control, and they all went to jail. But the Queen of France was blamed for actually buying the diamond when she had nothing to do with it. And
okay, that's interesting. Yeah, that's it's interesting this stuff, because when I started doing my book on cons and hoaxes, and you start coming across all of these pretty amazing stories. I wasn't familiar with that one, for example, but this is one reason I enjoy doing this kind of work, the kind of crime writing, because you keep, you know, discovering all this weird stuff that I'd never heard of, and it's like, whoa, that's pretty fascinating. There's all sorts of, and there's actually quite a few things that didn't make it into my book because I ran out of space. Sad to say, you know, I wasn't able to squeeze in everything. I had some stuff about a guy who was pretending to go online, and he would go online and pretend to be Justin Bieber or something and, you know, get girls to send him nude pictures.
Yeah.
And that didn't make it in, and a few other things like that, because I just ran out of space. And there was, you know, topics I didn't end up exploring because it's just like there was so much material that, you know, it's kind of depressing in a way, but good for me, but depressing for humanity, I guess, that there were so many frauds that, you know, it was...
It's all part of it. We all want to be rich. We all want to be rich. We all want to be famous.
Yeah,
we all want Justin Bieber to fall in love with us, so I will send him my picture of me being nude. You know, obviously, it's Justin Bieber. He loves me.
Exactly.
You know, and I know when we do our deep dive with the Dixie Mafia, one of the things we're looking at is how a bunch of people in Gola Prison set up a fake Lonely Hearts Club. Where they
really?
Men, that's quite fascinating. They killed the judge, the circuit judge, Judge Sherry, and his wife. The short version there is this guy, criminal, he's in jail. He made up fake proof. It was internet age, postal stuff. These people existed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking for gay men that once they got out of prison they could live with, right?
Right, right, right.
These gay men on the outside wanting to have a boyfriend, you know, have somebody with a wife, sent the money. And then that got to be quite the sum. And then some of that money disappeared between the crooks, and all the crooks, you know, figure out who got the money, who stole the money, and whether the crooks said, well, I didn't have to do that, it was this judge here. My old law partner did it. And so he was killed with his wife.
Wow.
That would be Judge Sherry, and happened in Mississippi.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one. I'll have to listen to your podcast to hear that one. That sounds quite amazing.
You should. I mean, that would be, and I have the daughter of the sheriff, the sheriff, that she thinks was murdered because of that whole situation with the Dixie Mafia will be on either next week or the week after. It's quite the story to think that things like this occur. And
This is all part of, you know, like why it's cool to write about crime and to be involved with the podcasting and stuff, because I keep learning new stuff, and that case just kind of blows my mind in a way. So definitely, you know, worth a listen. That's pretty amazing. If I could mention one of the ones that I really kind of feasted on in my book was a guy named Professor Paul Frampton, not to be mistaken for Peter Frampton, the guitar player. This guy, Oxford educated, taught physics at University of North Carolina, and he's in his late 60s, and, you know, he separates from his wife. He's lonely, wants to try a little online dating. Okay, no problem. So joins an online dating site, 2011, and almost immediately gets hit on by this woman named Denise, who's 32, so half his age, and a Bolivian bikini model. So she's got a profile, you know, filled with, you can imagine, lots of, you know, provocative photos. Oh, here I am in my new bikini. Ooh. So he exchanges hundreds of emails. And, you know, he's kind of like, what the, you know, why are you interested in me? I'm like twice your age. I'm a professor. I'm pretty boring. And she's like, oh, no. I like an older man. You know, men my age only care for my body. And I want an older man who's intelligent and I can talk to. So he's like, oh, yeah, okay, that sounds great. So he decides to fly to Bolivia to meet meet Denise. And during all this time, he's never actually talked to her on the phone or done any Skype or anything like that. So he's never actually spoken to her. They've just done these emails. goes to Bolivia and discovers she's not at the hotel where she had arranged to meet him. She left a note there saying, well, I had to rush off to, you know, Belgium for a photo shoot, and I can meet you there. But, oh, hey, I forgot. Can you just take this suitcase with you? Because I kind of left it behind. You know, can you just take it with you? So Frampton, you know, Professor Frampton says, okay, whatever. And, of course, he doesn't look in the suitcase. And I think you can probably see where I'm going with this. He goes to customs, and the first question they ask is, you know, what's with this extra suitcase? And he's like, oh, well, my Bolivian bikini model girlfriend gave it to me. And they're like, what's in it? And he's like, oh, I don't know. So they open it up. Sure enough, it's full of cocaine. So yeah. He was thrown in jail, served time in Brazil, loses his job in North Carolina. And turns out it was all a setup from a drug trafficking gang that there actually was a bikini model named Denise, but she had nothing to do with the scam, that they stole her photo and stole her profile to sucker guys like this professor to smuggle drugs for them. And he kind of woefully realized this after serving his time in jail. So here was a guy, like, you know, very intelligent, went to some of the best university in the world and taught physics, you know, and he fell for this most ridiculous scam imaginable. And so if he could be fooled, I think a lot of other people could be fooled too. So that was one of my favorite little ones that I covered, you know, not to scoff at someone who ends up in jail, but it so taps into, like, you can see this older, deluded dude thinking, ooh, this hot young bikini babe is really into me. Sure, I'll do everything you say, honey. You know what I mean? Like, she knows how to play him like a, you know, like a toy.
Well, who wouldn't be? I mean, God, in my advanced age, when I'm busy admiring my Eiffel Tower in France, if some young girl walks up to me and says, gee, Wayne, baby, I don't care that you're older than my grandfather is. I just love you so much. Will you do this for me? Will you do that for me? Sweet. Of course I will. Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course. No problem. Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah, well.
I mean, we all can fall for everything.
Yeah, if money tends to cloud people's judgment, so does sex. So that's one reason why these romance frauds are so common, that people get caught up in some love or lust fantasy, and then they don't realize they've been ripped off. So
yes.
Keep that in mind, guys. If you're, you know, middle-aged like me and you get some emails from some hot bikini babe, probably not,
especially,
you know,
Julia.
Not on the line, yeah. Not on the, you know, probably a rip-off.
So what is another story that perhaps you'd like to talk about that wasn't able to make it to your book, sir?
Let's see, another story that didn't make it in. Let me think. Well, somewhat nasty, but I did a thing about snuff movies that didn't make it in because they didn't really like the topic. This is the concept that people make movies in which people are actually killed, and you know, it's not acting, and you have to get specific with the definitions, because there have been cases of criminals who will videotape some horrible crime they did and even put it on the internet, but if they're not trying to make money from it, then it ain't a snuff film. Okay, so I was working under pretty strict. The idea of a snuff movie is that it's done for commercial purposes. It's not just like a souvenir from some sicko serial killer. So there was a movie in the 70s called Slaughter, you know, really imaginative title. And it was made, I think, in 1971. And what happened was the people who made it tacked on a new ending and changed the title to Snuff, and then they promoted it with this total BS campaign that, you know, ooh, this might have been filmed in South America where life is cheap, and they deliberately provoked a lot of controversy about their own film. I think they might have even hired protesters to protest it, and it was all crap. Like, this new ending where supposedly someone's killed was just a scam. So they're very cleverly jumping on this kind of like urban, you know, myth or this sort of mythology of snuff movies to make a buck. But it was complete nonsense. And things might have changed since I wrote that. That was about 2 years ago. But as far as I'm aware, no one has ever, they've never uncovered an actual commercially available snuff production. Like the idea is that, you know, the film crew set out to make this, and this wasn't just some crazy killer filming their own crap, but some film crew set out to make this, murdered people, then sold it to make money. The whole thing, I mean, like, you, there's easier ways to make an to make a living. So, you know, you'd have to go through quite a bit of effort to do that. But that was one that didn't make it in, sad to say. But I thought it was interesting how the filmmakers had exploited the controversy and outrage. You know, like they would deliberately provoke, you know, they'd write letters to the editor of newspapers saying, oh, this film is awful, this film is outrageous, and don't ever see it, you know, and you know, how could anyone be so depraved to make such a movie? And of course, you know, people read that and go, ooh, I gotta see that movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
that goes on all the time in any filmmaking.
So that didn't, that sadly didn't make it in, but maybe a future endeavor. So we'll see.
Maybe a future endeavor. I'm sure you have more than enough stuff for books, but you bring up an interesting idea with film using out of the world marketing, probably taking advantage of people to sell copies or get people to buy tickets. Yeah, I mean, remember Tingler? Back, I think, in the
60s. For people who don't know, that was this, I think the guy's name was William Castle. He was a film producer in the 50s, and he was notorious for having these gimmicks to go with his movies. And so he made this movie, I think it was actually called The Tingler, or The Creeping Terror,
correct,
or some. Pardon me?
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
And... Yes, yeah, and so the idea was this, in this movie, that this monster would eat you and you'd feel a tingling sensation in your spine and you had to scream to, for whatever reason, it, you know, oh yeah, screaming will you know, prevent you from dying or something. So in the movie, there's a scene where the creature goes into a movie theater and then he had rigged up some of the seats to tingle. So people would feel like they'd get a mild shock in their butt, basically, and you were supposed to scream, you know, and it was all just, yeah, a complete scam. It's gone down in history as kind of like, I don't think anyone was fooled by this, but everyone thought it was kind of cute, I guess you could say.
It's cute. I mean, and that's the thing about film, if I'm, because I idealize a film. And people want to have that cuteness. They want to be that person that can feel the tingle and have to scream, or whatever it might be. Or I'll see this movie called Serbian Film, which I don't recommend anybody see, but it takes place, obviously, in Serbia, where it portrays a bunch of people being sucked into snuff films.
Oh, right. That one. I haven't seen it. I've heard about it.
Yep. And that's pretty weird. And again, people protest that, but they want to be protested. Because the more of you protest, the more they get to say, well, this is an art, you know,
right,
by the movies.
Right,
you know,
right. One other interesting cinematic thing that I covered is my book, The Big Con, also looked at hoaxes. And one thing that you still hear about today is this concept of subliminal subduction. And the idea was that they would put like a little, like one frame in a movie of something, and it would like register unconsciously. And the classic, allegedly classic experiment with this was this film theater allegedly put in like split second frame saying like eat popcorn or, you know, drink a soda, and their, you know, refreshment stand sales went through the roof. And it turned out to be complete crap, that this study was, you know, wildly inaccurate. And they had a number of people who testified and said that even if they did this in a movie, you wouldn't be, it wouldn't register, it wouldn't do anything. So you can have a film with little you know, one frame things that says kill everybody and you wouldn't notice it and it wouldn't do anything.
Right.
You know, similar to like when, you know, they used to sell these tapes that would learn a language overnight and you would play it while you slept. And the idea was you would learn how to speak French by having this tape recording of someone going on in French while you slept. And they didn't work. Like, this was like, that doesn't work. That brain doesn't work
right.
in that way. But that was a fun one I covered. A lot of the stuff in my book was kind of serious and grim, but that was kind of a fun one that, you know. And people are still convinced this is absolutely, you know, I still meet people who say, oh, well, you know, and movie companies will put like a picture of popcorn in the film and then you'll go out and rush out and buy popcorn. And you're like, well, I certainly hope people aren't that suggestible. That wouldn't say too much about our, you know, average moviegoer if that was true.
No, we can take a minute to example of the documentary about Michael Jackson that played at Sundance.
Uh-huh,
okay.
And
psychiatrist available to those people who were triggered by something they saw in the movie.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so how much of that was because we have a society today that thinks they can be triggered and can, you know, handle rough stuff or, you know, knowing that might be there, or a marketing ploy to get people that might not usually saw something like that to come.
Right. Probably a combination of thereof, you know, like, you know, somebody who said, you know, hey, you know, hey, here's an idea. We'll do this and we'll look sensitive and make a buck at the same time because it makes the film more controversial. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the idea is you get those little tickets and you get those copies of the film out there and get people to buy them.
Exactly. Exactly. It's all about buying.
All about buying, all about the money. How do we find the gullible? And to me, if I go to Hooters, I mean, I love Hooters. I'm going to give them a shout-out because I love Hooters. I love Passaways of Hooters. I love the hotel chain. I love the restaurant chain. I love Hooters, Hotel and Casino. There goes a shout-out for today's show. Good. I go there, and I know that the girls are well-dressed to just advertise their wares, right? I know that they get a flirt with me because they know at the end of the day I'm going to tip them well. I'm going to eat their food that's probably a little bit overpriced, but I walk away from the experience like I'm in a movie. I feel good. You know, it's money well spent. That's one thing you might say, I've been conned, and maybe I have been. It's another thing, as we discussed, when the fake utility people go to see Mrs. Smith, who's in her 80s, rip off her money. Or Joe and Sam that run a dump and pump and dump scheme to get somebody to invest in a fake marijuana company.
Yeah, you make a good point because there are some day-to-day things that are more or less, technically it's a con. Here's an example. You go to the hairdresser and you're a guy and the hairdresser is female and she makes a few comments, oh, you've got really good hair, you know, or, you know, that shirt looks really nice. And you know deep inside that, you know, she's probably saying that for a tip and she probably knows you know. But it's kind of like you go with it because it's just a nice thing. You feel kind of complimented. Or you're in a store and, you know, the clerk comments about, you know, oh, that's a really nice pair of shoes you've got on. You know, those are really great. You know, where did you get them? And, again, same thing. Like, you know, they're kind of buttering you up and it's, you know, they're probably trying to just break you down a bit to get, you know, to buy something or tip them. But you go with it. You're not, you know, it's not offensive. It's not for big bucks. And they're not blatantly trying to rip you off. It's just sort of something you accept. So, yeah, you're right. There are little things like that that are like, okay, whatever. And I'm willing to tolerate that.
Are you familiar with what a cold read is?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you want to elaborate or should I?
You go for it. Well, sir, you go for it because I have a last story before you go.
Okay, fair enough. A cold read, well, technically it's sort of something that you would do like with a, you know, person who's like a fortune teller, although it's a technique that can be used by anybody, like a politician or a sales clerk. And what it means basically is the cold reader doesn't know anything about this person in front of them. like they have no information at all, but they make some observations and they can make some guesses about certain things about their personality, okay? So, for example, they'd look for a wedding ring. You know, look on your hands, look in a wedding ring. Take a look at your clothing. Are they wearing, like, really frayed, ripped-up shirts, or are they wearing, like, a Brooke Brothers suit? That'll immediately tell you a bit about their financial status, you know, hairstyle, and age. That's another big one, that you go to a fortune teller. If you're in your 20s, they're going to look in their bowl and say, I see a wedding. And you're like, oh, my God, you're right. You know, all my friends are getting married. Well, no shit, because you're in your 20s. You go to a fortune teller in your 40s or 50s, they say, oh, I'm really sorry. I see a funeral in your future. And you're like, oh, my God, you're right. You know, my father just died. And it's like, well, again, no shit. You're in your 40s or your 50s. So, you know, your parents' generation would be at the point where they're dying. So that's a cold read. And again, it's something that a lot of people do. Like, politicians are very good at this often. Like, you know, someone will approach them with an issue. They'll look the person over and immediately sort of come to some judgments, and they kind of know what to say based on, like, they'll look very carefully at their clothes, or maybe they've got a button that they're wearing that has some sort of cause on it, and formulate their answers like that. So that's kind of my definition of a cold read, if you have a story.
That's a good
or...
definition.
Okay,
and
thank you.
The reason why I bring that up is we talked about harmless things, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I do tarot readings, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do fortune telling.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
I don't think I do cold reads, right?
Okay.
Until it's explained to me, and not only how you explained it, but another way. Because my parents were alcoholics, severe, bad alcoholics.
Okay.
I had to know what they were going to do based on visual clues.
Oh.
You know, was it safe to be around the house, or did I have to leave, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I just find that whole thing fascinating, how cold reads can be used. It's like anything. Is the waitress at Hooters who says, hey, Mr. Klingman,
mm-hmm.
it's really nice to see you today. I really liked you in your movie. I know
mm-hmm.
she probably never saw the movie I made, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it makes
mm-hmm.
you feel good, right? When
well,
she comes over, I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm. And to sort of, you know, just to sort of explain, like when you talk about your own situation like that, a cold read can be a positive thing. Policemen do cold reads all the time. Someone approaches them on the street or they approach someone. They have got to very, very quickly make an assessment about what's going on. And they kind of use some of those cold read techniques, like looking at their clothes, their body clues, the way they talk, you know, the hair, you know, all these things. So the example you had mentioned about your childhood, sorry about your family situation, but that's a very positive way of kind of just looking and making some good observations on what you see.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow.
By the way, where can we find your books online, and where can we find you online, sir?
Okay, well, the big con is from a company called ABC Clio. They primarily do textbooks for junior college and high school, so you can either go to my website, which is natehendley.com, NateHendley.com, and I have all my books listed on my website with links where you can buy them, and of course, just Amazon and Barnes & Noble, or you can go to ABC Clio and do a search for my name, and all my stuff is there. The ABC Clio does not generally sell books in stores, per se, but they're all available online. And
website.
Yeah, my website probably would be the simplest way to get anything.
Absolutely. And what's your Twitter handle, sir?
You caught me off guard. Let me check. let me tell you in 1 second. I should know this off the top of my head, but unfortunately I don't. I wouldn't make a very good cold reader. Okay. Sorry, it is twitter.com/NateHendley. So NateHendley.
Right.
Or you can just do a search on Twitter on my name. I'm also on, you know, Facebook, LinkedIn, all that good stuff.
Outstanding.
So I'm all over the place.
I have to find you on LinkedIn. Thank you, sir, for your time. Little
yeah.
English lady told me it's time to kick us off the air because she hates me.
Okay.
It's
well.
When I sold her back in the 20s. I want to thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you.
I learned a lot from you. And I really appreciate having the Eiffel Tower. Talk to you later.
I really learned a lot from you, too. And my deal for the Brooklyn Bridge, the paperwork will be in the mail. So just wait for that, okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you again, sir. Yeah.
Thank you. You take care. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We're out of time. Talk to you all later. Bye.
Okay, bye.